This episode is brought to you by Voodoo Ranger. It's beer. It's hoppy, trend-setting, innovative, served with a little sarcasm, just like Paper House Network.
Paper House Network is hoppy?
Yeah. It's like beer for your ears. Get yourself a Voodoo Ranger!
I brought back the sigh. All right, everybody. The big sigh's back. We have another guest. Look, I went to journalism school for years. I really should be better at throwing the guests, but look, I'm not. This gentleman is someone I really respect. He's an absolute legend in New York comedy. He's been on a million things. This dude has done movies. He's done TV appearances. He's been with legends. He's a killing machine. We'll probably talk about that. Uh-huh. This is my friend, Brian Scott McFadden.
Hey, I love these overhyped intros. You know what I mean? Because I never recognize myself when I hear some of these intros. I always just go, "Wait a minute, is there another guest coming in?" I prefer to see myself as like some kind of weird cult figure, acquired taste. What's another one that I get a lot? One of comedy's best kept secrets.
Ooh.
I don't know.
How do you feel when you hear shit like that?
It's funny. It's nice to hear that, like, you have the respect of your peers, but I also there's a level of, like, you know, when people don't recognize, you know, I'm sort of not the most I don't have the most name recognition of people in the industry. I may be a respected comic, and I accept that description. But there's also, like, you know, this guy's a legend. And then people go, he's a legend. I love hearing it. Don't get me wrong. And I love joking around about it. But I always wonder how you're supposed to consider yourself in this industry in terms of, like, those kinds of grandiose expectations or presentations of yourself.
Well, see, that's interesting. I think that you do so well because you have that feeling towards that.
Yeah, I think, probably.
I've noticed some people on the come up, man, no one corrects you about their credits more than persons who just got one. It's like, yo, man, as a host, sometimes you forget, you hear the same things over and over and you confuse them. And so sometimes you're going to say someone did Conan when they did Colbert. Yeah. And the person who corrects you or gives you shit is like, oh, you're insecure.
Yeah, yeah. Most people if you've been around the merry-go-round enough, you realize that how relatively unimportant that stuff is. There's like sometimes I have like a movie credit or something, and somebody will mention it, or you know, I had a small part in a movie, and then that gets mentioned sometimes, and they put it on the marquee sometimes, and it's like, look, I had two lines in that movie. And there's like, you know what I mean? Like, but then I decided to write a bit about it.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that I had two lines in the So I'd say, use that credit just so I can do
just
this.
So you can get to that
even
chunk.
Though it sounds, he was in this movie. And then people come up to me after the show. They're like, what were you in that? Oh, I was the flight attendant. I that interacted with them in the one scene there. You know, it's like, yeah. And so, yeah, yeah. And people go, oh, you know. It's just always funny, the credits and what they signify and what they mean.
You know, in Europe, apparently, I haven't been there. I was supposed to go, and this little situation of COVID happened.
You've never been to Europe?
No, never. I've never left North America. I've been to Mexico, Canada, and Jamaica, the big three.
Wow.
And it's always been told to me that credits don't matter there. Like people tell me who are from there, MCs who are usually the second best comic or even the best comic on the bill, they totally look at things different. Will be an American will go up and go, hey, I've been on this and that. And they're like, cool. What do you want me to do with that? I'm just going to say your next performer and you
have to entertain
these drunks in Manchester.
Yeah. I don't know what that is. There's so many differences in Europe, especially like England in show business. You know, you see unattractive people in lead roles in England, you know, and their training is so much better than ours in terms of acting. We not to say we don't have great actors in America, but it's so fascinating we very rarely go there and take jobs away from the Brits. You know, they're constantly taking lead roles. Abraham Lincoln, Nixon. Are you kidding me? You know, like, you know.
That's very interesting because yeah, they always said that there's a lot of Americans who could have been James Bond. And I think Cary Grant basically was the basis for the movies because of North by Northwest. But I guess he's technically English, but he didn't have the accent. But the most American roles are superheroes. And a lot of them get like Spider-Man is what last two have been British.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
That tends to happen. And Batman, there's been another British guy's playing Batman. It's like, that won't happen the other way.
Yeah.
That's not going
to. I'm waiting for like, I don't even know if woke culture will address this and say that if you're a British, you can't relate to the American experience. You know, you're like, why can't I go? And if you're, you know, why can't I say, look, what is a British guy? And I think Samuel L. Jackson said that about the guy who played, Daniel Kaluuya played, what was the movie that just came out? Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yeah.
Fred Hampton. And I think Samuel Jackson said, what does he know about the Black experience in America? Right. Because he's British or something. And it's like, wow, that was never a consideration in from any artistic perspective that I ever imagined in terms of like what you always thought as an actor, you can play a different role because you get it, you empathize with what someone suffered or whatever, and then you use that in your craft to play someone that you're not. So that's the whole point of being an actor, is playing, not just playing yourself, whatever. But
yeah, that's what's gotten kind of really crazy about that. Like I'm not an actual actor. I was in theater in high school. I'm most theatrical class of 96. Shout out to me, baby. But it isn't acting taking a role? Like, so what are we going to do? So no one can ever play King Arthur.
Right.
What do you know about running? Yeah. Like, you can't play a fictional character. Cause what do you know of playing someone from 2300? Like, what do we know of that?
What do you play? A caveman. How do you play an animal? How do you play, anything, an alien? You know, it's like Jeff Bridges played a space a guy from, you know, another the galaxy in Starman. So he can't do that because that's not his lived experience. That was like one of the I know this is a completely different topic. We're off to the races here on something completely different. But that's a very strange new wrinkle. And I understand the there's a separate issue about representation in the arts where you say that someone someone who's white or something shouldn't be playing this character because the people that should be playing that character haven't been given opportunities to be represented. And that's a different issue. That's completely different. That's not an artistic determination. If you want to say that an Indian actor should play like this Indian character because they don't get a chance to do that, and you don't want to do the whole makeup thing and which is considered like degrading, and you know, Mickey Rooney playing an Asian,
the most famous character example.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think at least got nominated for an Oscar or won an Oscar for playing Yellowface. It's one of the most craziest things ever. Not only did it happen, motherfucker got some hardware for that shit.
Yeah. He got nominated for that?
I want to say he got nominated.
I don't think he got nominated.
I'm going to look it up.
Breakfast at Tiffany's? That was like Mickey Rooney's like, that's new to me, man.
I really think he got nominated for Best Supporting.
No, I think you might be mistaken, but
I hope I'm mistaken.
If you're not mistaken, that's frightening.
A lot of people don't want to be mistaken and proven wrong on their own show. I fucking pray. I've never prayed to be wrong.
I really do. I hope you're wrong. But but while you look that up, I'll just pontificate about this because that, like I said, that's a separate issue. Saying that because certain groups haven't been represented in Hollywood in terms of like getting roles and have been, you know, John Wayne playing, I don't know, Genghis Khan or whatever he did. I can't remember. Or whatever.
Yes.
But he did get nominated?
No, he didn't. But yes, on John Wayne. Thank God. I love that I don't know everything. But yes, John Wayne is Genghis Khan.
We dodged a bullet on that one. Ooh. That would have been frightening. But that's a separate, like I said, that's a separate issue from the artistic idea, which is that someone couldn't play that because that's, or couldn't play that truthfully I mean, what's his name played my left foot, you know, he's never had any kind of like,
he wasn't missing a foot. Well, that's where it gets interesting too. Cause like, didn't Bryan Cranston play someone in a wheelchair?
Yeah.
And I mean, look guys, let's just be honest. And we'll probably talk more stand up here in a second, or we won't. We're going to talk. How many people who are paraplegics could carry a movie? You have to also factor that. That is something that, unfortunately, this is a business. This is something we do talk about in this podcast, is that this is all about art and the journey, but there's aspects of it, there's parts of it that involve being able to service people who provide comedy to the masses or to a few. And there's a business aspect to what we do. That's why we're allowed to come and talk about this and talk about our weekend schedules, because there's a market in that, and the market dictated, at least the thought was, Bryan Cranston is going to draw more than the nine, or what, all due respect to anyone who's a wheelchaired actor.
Right.
That I don't know any right now, so I can't imagine any of them could carry that fucking movie in the eyes of the studio. Doesn't mean they wouldn't have done well.
Once again, that's another issue. Is like, it's that's also a separate issue. Is there a wheelchair run actor who could carry that movie? Maybe. But they don't have a name of that Bryan Cranston does. Now, you could also then go, well, how are they going to get the name if they don't get roles? You know? Like, so, and we're off to the races. There's some truth and representation there. But that's a separate issue, once again, for saying that someone can't play a gay character because they wouldn't, that's not their lived experience. Like, which is this new term that just came out to talk about, to basically say that you know, actors or performers of any kind, the only thing they can play is them, because they don't have the experience. Well, Jim Carrey wasn't, you know, Andy Kaufman. He didn't have cancer or whatever, and he still played. I mean, you could give the examples are numerous, but I think it's just basically, if you want to say, I just wish that argument was just be taken off the table, because I think it's silly. And if you just want to argue the representation point, that's a legitimate debate to have, and a legitimate, it's not even a debate. It's something that's a legitimate point that should be addressed more. But the idea that you can't play this character, and the best example of that is in movies, in cartoon movies, they use big stars to play these characters. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid growing up, we would go to see a cartoon movie and we didn't know who the guy was, and we didn't go see it because, you know, Sylvester Stallone is the voice of an ant in this movie. You know what I mean? Like, and I just, the Disney movies, nobody knew who they were. It's like Beauty and the Beast. Do you know anyone in that movie? Like, does anyone, like, you know, there are some names in that film. Robbie Benson played the Beast, but most people have no idea who, and Angela Lansbury was the teacup, I think Jerry Orbach was in it, but most people don't hear it and go, oh my God, I have to go see that movie. You know, because that voice of that actor that I like is doing that. You know, most people went to see the movie because the cartoon sold the movie, but that's not the case anymore. You know,
things have changed. It is about drawing, which is weird. John Lasseter and I talked last week about, it's interesting, like, who draws and like who fills roles. And it's tough. You're talking about like the best kept secret shit. That's why when you brought up, I asked it, it's like, seriously, Brian's an absolute killer. I'm not going to make you uncomfortable again. I'm very interested that you're doing this, because and we are friends, but it's one of those things that's strange to me. I was intimidated to talk to you because in my mind, so it's taken me years to become friendly with certain people. And I hope people understand that there will be guests on this show that I am cool with. But if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I barely made eye contact. I would just ask what what's your credit? You were killing at the clubs when I was just trying to get in them. And then when I started emceeing, you would close almost every show and just light the fucking, it's like that scene in Goodfellas where they lighten the match in the bamboo lounge before they bust it out. And it just, boom. And so it's intimidating to talk to people who just crush like that. And that, you just know, as this, like, to me, you're like a comedian machine. You're one of the most consistent dudes ever. You just lock into your bits and take the crowd with you and close a show. Dante Nero, who's going to be a guest eventually, we were doing a list once. This is hilarious. Not that many white people, white dudes close shows. It is a rare number. And you were on the goddamn list. It's like, oh, yeah, McFadden can close a show. McFadden can close a show.
Me represent the white the white male comics. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, they need a lot of representation. Well,
thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice to hear from a fellow comic that I respect, because I've always thought of you as one of the best MCs, because you take it really, really seriously. You recognize that role is very important to a show. It used to be more revered on a show. Sure. And it was always a thought of, but now some people think, or some places think, I can put anyone in that spot. And it does such damage. And I've seen so many MCs who do such damage to a show that you're doing damage control when you go up. You're correcting the mistakes that are made. You're putting out fires that have been started. And it's like such a pain in the ass. Instead, if you want somebody to elevate the show, not bury it under six, tons of debris that you have to dig a hole out of, you know, it's a fascinating dynamic.
And I've seen it. So let's bring this. Let's discuss this. So you do close a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think the lineup matters so much? Do you think that booking a show in your years of experience, and how long have you been doing this now?
Since the 90s.
Yeah. God bless.
Yeah.
So 20 plus years.
Yeah.
Do you think booking should be more of a curation? Like that it really, there's an importance to who host goes first, goes second, third, closes. Do you think it's almost like telling a story in a movie? There's a beginning, middle, end, and an arc to this? Well, or do you think it can be random?
I think that would be ideal, but the skill sets are so unevenly distributed among people. Being an MC is something some people don't either care about it enough to get good at it, or they just see it as a transition thing that they just want to get out of, and they sort of abandon or resent having to be in that role, or don't want to do it. Some people enjoy it and also recognize it. It's not to say that that's where they always want to stay. They also want to close, but if they're in the MC spot or they're placed in that situation, they recognize that that's a specific role that requires a skill set that and some kind of recognition of what you're supposed to do for the show. But I don't think the days are ever going to be there where are they going to bring back the era of like where the MC was like seen as absolutely vital all the time. No, because they're cutting corners and they just want to throw somebody new guy up there or something like that. So, but the good clubs will always recognize that they don't want to throw somebody up there who's just going to tank it, you know, like
oh, man, it happens.
On the road and you'll see some, they'll get some guy who's a local guy who'll tell jokes, you know, it's just like, oh God, help me, you know? And what that does is it wires the audience in a specific way that makes their expectation level, not just, I won't even say lower, but just different from what comedy really is. You know what I'm talking about. It's as if somebody goes up there and does jokes, and then you go up doing like either observational material or passionate material. The audience looks at you like you're just a weird creature until they suddenly go, oh, this is what comedy is. And they have to adjust back to what stand-up is really supposed to be as an art form, instead of just, you know, some kind of vaudevillian kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with like a joke here and there or something like that, but there are people who use that as a crutch or don't know how else to close or never came up with a closer.
Yeah.
you know. My father told me, and it was a lesson I always learned. He said, if you, and this is for better or for worse, one thing I was always good at, one skill I always take pride in is like my father said, the last 5 minutes of your act is all they'll remember, right? So I always said, I always prided myself on having a killer closing bit.
You always do.
Right? You know, like I wrote, like I have like a handful of them that I've written over the years that were like, okay, no matter what happens, if I can hang on like a cat on a screen door for the first like 10, 15 minutes and get to my closer, you know what I mean? Like I'll own them, you know? So I always said, have a killer closer, that you, you know, opening and closing are very important. What you open with, what you close with. And I've always been better at closing than opening. Sometimes I go up, you know, not just trying to figure out the crowd and what to do before I kick into gear.
I think that's the toughest thing. And I've hosted all these years and I'm now like embracing it the last week. I'll be like, I catch myself in the middle doing, hey, how are you? And I go, you guys don't want to answer this yet. And if you don't answer it, I'm going to feel like you're shitty and we get in a bad mood. So, hey, man, great. It's so tough to meet strangers who are there to see a show.
Yes.
Maybe see you, indirectly seeing you. And you're like, how do you do this? I mean, it's an interesting closing in a sense isn't easier, especially what you do. I mean, you build them to this simmer. And it's amazing, but it's so strange to say hello to a comedy audience.
Yeah, I mean, and you're saying that, and you're good at it, and you do it all the time, and you take pride in it, but you're talking about it like it's this, it is a bizarre.
I still don't think I'm great at it.
What's that?
I've been hosting, I do okay as a host, I have a decent reputation, I've been doing this 20 years. I still think I need to improve at it, to be fucking blunt.
I think everyone does, you know, and that's what makes you good at it is that you're filled with torturous self-doubt. Like
we all are.
We're all vexed by our own insecurities into hopefully aspiring to greatness in order to compensate for that. So that's basically what it comes down to. Most of the people that think they're great, I mean, that's a cliche though, because there are some cocky people out there, you know.
There are.
It's like when I first opened for Seinfeld, and I remember he was just so calm as a cucumber, just so confident. Nothing rattled the guy. And you would think, well, that means that he's compensating. It's like, no, he wasn't compensating.
He is.
Like Muhammad Ali knew he was great, you know, like he was like, I'm the greatest. So you always think, oh, somebody brags like that. It's not that simple, that simplistic dynamic where we think somebody who's tortured and hates, you know, and hates what they do and beats themselves up. That's what makes them great. It's like, no, there's a lot of people that beat themselves up and don't get great or that is ruinous to their self-esteem, to their artistic output. So there's no cliche that really fits everybody. Your insecurity about being an MC, you want to be better at it. And that's what a true artist does. And they want to aspire to improve all the time and never settle and just go, I'm just great at this. You know what I mean? I'm just great. But you know that you're good as an MC.
I have confidence. Yes.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's times that I even sabotage myself up front. Mm-hmm. Since coming back indoors, I had a loose script that I used to do. When I go up, and I've discussed on this like episodes ago, probably a year ago, and I've changed them because the world changed and I'm not using them. And I didn't care about a laugh. If I got a smile or a chuckle, I could tell the audience was okay, but it was something to get me started. It was almost like warming myself up on stage.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's important. It's interesting, like as a comic, like to have rituals to get yourself going and like habits. It's almost like in basketball, they tell you like when you shoot free throws, if you dribble three times the first one, you better the second one. You see it. LeBron does the same thing every time. There's a consistency.
That's a great discussion to have. I don't know how much of a deep dive you've always done on that, but like where's the line between having that rigid, disciplined kind of chunk, especially in an MC where you're dealing with that, you know, people just sitting down, you're dealing with people getting food, you're dealing with all shit that once the show is established, you're the guy that like puts out so many fires as an MC that you know, sometimes your job can be much easier when you go up the show earlier or later. The placement in the show is so important. Like I hate being first on a show. Like after the MC, I don't like that spot either because you've just warmed them up. But technically, you're the first comedian going up and doing pure material.
Yes.
If that's what you do. And the audience isn't quite wired for that because they've had that other experience of being part of the show. So they expect that. That's kind of hardwired into them at that moment. So I'll go up in that first spot and it's always, and any comic will say this, after a few comedians have set the table and then it's better to go up third or fourth.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Two to me is always the sweetest spot. The drinks are out. They probably are halfway through their first drink. And at that point, the server's not asking anyone for drinks. So there's no distraction there. And mad love to servers. It's a tough job to do. Some people do it way better than others. I can't say I would not be loud. I would hope I wouldn't, but it happens. That second spot, they're conditioned, they're relaxed.
Now, meaning after the first, the MC, first comic, second spot.
Second comic, yes.
Because a lot of people, there's a controversy over, we would go, you're a first comedian. And people go, don't do that. You're the first comedian. You're the MC. And it's like, I always think that's absolutely true. Okay. But there is a difference in the roles that you portray. And you are the first comedian and you're the MC. I agree with that definition, but it's one of those things we discuss in the comedy world, the minutia of the comedy world. Is the MC a comic? Should they portray themselves as, you know, like, should they say they are? And it's like, yeah, I think that's fine. You know, like, of course, your next comedian, whatever. How do you feel?
No, that is an interesting thing that, because like I said, one of the reasons I started this pod is because people would come up and go, hey, when are you going to do comedy? You're a good host. They don't think you're a comic. So it's weird that I do prescribe to me, the one spot is the guy after, or woman, is after the host. And why I say that is because when you look at the list, it will say MC or host, and then 1, 2, 3. So I look at it like you're the pitcher.
Yeah.
You're not playing, you're not in that batting, especially in the American League, you're not in the batting lineup, but you're fucking playing, and you're very important to the game. Yeah. But you're not in the lineup like that. You're doing something. You're serving something else for them. And that's how I look at it. Is like, you're a specialist. You're setting the table for the other acts. And that's why I look at that. But I do, it is weird when someone goes first. And I don't like going first either. And that's a different reason. I'll get to that. But when people go, oh, I got to bite the bullet. It's like, what the fuck do you think I'm doing as a host, or any of the hosts are doing? We're going out cold as shit. A lot of the times the intros are not awesome at places. They'll get like the new guy. Oh man, God bless it. There's been some people bring up, I hate to put the importance on that because the show, it's not the credits like we just discussed, but the first motion of a show is turning the music off and making that ghost mic announcement. And if you do it all fucked up, that's the first glimpse someone has of a show. And you're stuttering. I bet a guy bring me up. This is the best. Oh, shit. What did he do again? Whatever. Give it up for. And it's like, how do you, if you're not taking that serious, that's the first thing. How do they not think we're just like a crack house doing comedy at that point?
And it's really funny because there's so many, comedy's a fragile art form. Okay. It is fragile. There's so many things that can go off the rails. With music, I always feel like there's a lot more wiggle room because there's an emotional flow to it. And it just, if something goes wrong, they just plug in the mic and something shorts out or something and just you plow through. But with comedy, everything affects the mood of the vibe in the room. And there's such a rickety, it's a rickety balance of things. And stuff like that, exactly. When you get introduced like that, I used to always drive me crazy when they would play heavy rock music in a comedy club. Like, and I'm not even saying I'm right about this, right? Like, but it was always a sticking point for me. I say, play cool jazz, play laid back music that gets the audience into a mindset of listening to rhythm and quiet attentiveness, not
that's like, interesting.
I don't know what that's about and why that's more conducive to what's ostensibly a poetic kind of spoken word art form. You know, I never understand that, but I could be wrong. Maybe no one's tried it. I don't know. Maybe
I think in the clubs, absolutely. I think rhythm is a key, especially if there's several acts on the bill.
Yeah.
I think it's more important. Now, there's context and everything. Dustin Chafin used to do these great midnight shows at Broadway called Uncensored. It's in the title, Uncensored. You're seeing crazy. He would only play like AC/DC,
right,
old rock, or he'd play hip hop.
Right.
Now, that's the client, the people who are out at midnight for a show. Right. To me, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't need
anything for that. Yeah, I get that.
Need nothing bashing rock in that and that stuff I listen to sometimes before I go on.
Yeah.
Now, like when I was playing those outdoor shows, though, they felt more like concerts. Like during this pandemic, when I go to like Soul Joel's, I remember once, man, Ari Shaffir was doing two shows, and the first show, and you know, like Ari has such a following, and they're certain kind of people who come and see him, and he's this ultimate troll, so you think there's an edge.
Right.
And the energy was not there at the first show. I'm like, all right, it's weird. And so we're in the back, and I'm in my head, the show's fine. And then I walk out for a minute, because the green room's like a few feet away in a building. And I walk out, and we're going to start in like 10 minutes. And Billy Joel, Scenes from Italian Restaurants playing. And I go, oh my God, and it clicked. I'm like, oh my God, before I went on, they played Imagine by John Lennon. And I love that song. But that's totally different when you're there to see a headliner outdoors.
Yeah.
Big seating.
Yeah.
The clientele doesn't dictate playing fucking Cat Stevens.
Right. I get that. Yeah.
So I made that's him play this, but it's more about rhythm and upbeat.
Yes.
And stuff like that.
Yeah. Those outdoor things, I wasn't applying that to that because I can see where.
Totally different.
The focus of attention. You know, and getting the energy of the people, like some kind of Live Aid concert is very, very vital. So you need something a little more that's more rocky that way. I was just referring to the clubs.
Absolutely, though, in clubs. I think like an 80s playlist or like some funk. You can't go wrong in either setting with just playing like old George Clinton or Prince. Just something but rhythm. You said rhythm, and that to me is more important. Yeah, do you ever, I can't remember. You listen to me. You listen to your sets before you go on, right? You listen.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Do you ever listen to music before you go on, right on?
Yeah, but not as a ritual to get me into like a rhythmic thing. You know, I think it's partially because we're just running around so much that you don't have time to do any kind of meditative, you know, kind of like thing. But I do listen to music when I'm on my bike or going from gig to gig or something like that, you know.
Do you put any thought into it, or it's just randomly, all right, so I'm leaving stand up to go to the strip. All right, this song's queued up. I'm just going to listen to that. Or is there a certain thing you do like in that travel that gets your head correct?
There used to be when I first started, when I was a road, you know, road comic, and I worked with an older comedian who used to have a ritual where he would listen to, I can't remember what it was, but it was just some weird, funny rock and roll kind of stuff. Like, I don't know, Loudon Wainwright. I can't remember.
Wow, Loudon Wainwright.
Weird kind of like odd vaudevillian kind of something that got him into the rhythm of the show. And he needed to do that. There was some kind of come down thing that he had to do to get centered. That doesn't, I don't know why, but I don't do that.
That never worked for you.
No.
That wasn't your thing.
Yeah, it wasn't really my thing. But I can see where that would work for some people. I tend to like be more interested in what's going on in the club, who's on the show, what am I dealing with? You know, who's the MC? Because that, you know, who's been on before me? I don't always ask that. I'm not neurotic about it, but I always like when I walk into Stand Up New York or The Cellar or any New York Comedy Club, any place, I'll be like, who's on the show? Just so I know what they've seen, what kind of comedy's been presented, if there's any conflict or overlap or whatever, you know.
That's so lost now. That is so. It used to be you would ask the MC, hey, anything I should know. And I used to do that when I'd close shows and that is like, what should I know? And I used to give footnotes, like real cliff notes, actually, to people. All right, the dude up front is there and he won't show up and she's this. And I still will. But it seems like people don't ask as much anymore. And that's why, full disclosure, Brian and I worked together last night. And at the end of the show, I hung out for a minute. And there was there was a guy and a girl up front, if you remember. Yeah. And the guy is a gay dude, but everyone thought they were a couple initially. And then everyone figured it out. And I was explaining to them how if we're just trained of years of doing this, 9 out of 10 times we see a guy and a girl, they're together on a date or some shit. And how this happens so much now where it's brother, sister. And no one bothers to ask the MC, and we get the initial, Oh, that's my brother. Oh, okay. Then by the end of the show, like five comics have gone, so how long are you fucking? And it's still my brother. And I don't think to volunteer that to anyone, but I think that's probably should be on the onus of the comic going on to be like, anything I should know that's been said a bunch or anything right. like a running gag or anything that could be like that used to be a thing where you'd show up and be like, hey, what should I know? Yeah. They're not fucking, they're family, or he's a gay dude and she's crazy. Like some shit like that.
The guy that was an agent or something? He said he was an agent.
Oh, I don't know that. The girl had
You know, people say that all the time anyway, but like just to be show offs. But I know he might have been. He said he was an agent. I think he said he was an agent. And he might have been. Who the hell knows? You know, people go in there and say, I'm a hitman, you know, like when you ask him what you do, you know, you get all that shit all the time. But yeah. Yeah. There's a thing, like, I like to know, are there any trouble spots? Are there? But it depends also on the club, because some clubs are more loose with crowd control. And so there you tended to go, is there any fires I have to put out or anything I have to worry about? You know, because you just want to know what you're dealing with. But then again, you know, sometimes you just run into the club, you jump off your bike, you're there for 5 minutes. You don't have time to do an assessment of what nightmare you may be walking into or what great crowd you may deal with. I don't even know, you know?
See, that's valid. That's interesting because sometimes it is fight or flight. It really is sometimes. And sometimes that is the better way to deal with the shit, is not knowing, is just jumping in blindly into the water and you'll deal with it or not. And let your instincts take it over. But like any other job or task, you want to be as prepared as possible. And I've seen both work, and I've seen them both not work. But it's an interesting way to do it. If you're going in blind, you have to commit. You have to be like, I don't know shit about them, and I'm gonna make it work no matter what. And I don't care if it doesn't. I'm just going to do my thing in that moment and figure that out. But that is a commitment, and you have. There is no getting half pregnant on that shit. There's
gone back and forth on the whole. Do I want to know? Do I want to watch what other comedians have done? Do I want to watch some of the show? Do I want to sit in there? Like, it's a six of one, half dozen the other thing, because a lot of times you don't even have the opportunity to. You're just running in the room from another gig or something, so you don't know. But if you're there early, do I want to see what's going on in the club? Is there anything? You know, sometimes I do. Sometimes I think I've had my best sets when I just go in completely oblivious to what's happening. And then other times I've gone up going, I wish I knew about that.
It's so that interesting.
So there's no real hard, fast rules, once again, for stuff like this. You know, it's just a mishmash of trust your gut and hope for the best, and whatever happens, you know.
But isn't that I almost feel like that's the juice of our business. It's like, look, and this is a podcast about the love of it and also like etiquette and just technique it too, but like, be as prepared as you can. And that's because you get up every day and you work and you work on jokes and all that. But man, I kind of love the unpredictability. Like I got a show tonight and then I don't have anything for 6 days. I have to go home for something. And man, I hope it's great. I would love to get on that plane tomorrow knowing my last show was good, but I don't. And it's so fucking intriguing that the show might start with a fire I have to put out. I don't know when I walk into it what's going to happen. And I'm as prepared. Everything I do during the day, for the most part, is to get myself prepared when they call my name. And I still don't fucking know.
Yeah,
to me, that's the juice. That's why we do it.
Yeah, I know. And that's why people look at what we do with a mix of like, there's a mix of sometimes disrespect and awe, you know. They don't respect
combo.
Like so all of what we do. Oh, that's funny or whatever. And people show up and heckle us, like, you know, oh yeah, that's part of your job or something, which is so disrespectful of the art form itself. And then there's the other thing, which is, oh my God, I can't believe that you actually do this. That's an amazing thing what you do. Like, so there's this reverence and this contempt that
same time.
Yeah, at the same time.
Hey, I can do that.
Comedy never gets the respect
that it
deserves. I'm always awestruck by it. Comedy actors, you know, I always, that's like a pet peeve of mine. It's like, Eddie Murphy got nominated for Dreamgirls, and yeah. they interviewed him about it, and he said it was I can't remember the exact thing, but he basically said, "Did you see Nutty Professor when I played like 9 different characters, all different like that performance? No one could have done that. Like no, like." Dreamgirls is terrific in Dreamgirls or whatever, but there's other actors that you could say, all right, he probably could have played, played that character, but no one could have done what he did, and there's no award for that. Like there's no, the Academy just doesn't go, that's an incredible acting performance. It was heartbreaking in parts, it was gut-wrenching, and then they're just playing 17 different characters, and who could have done that? But the Academy doesn't go, that's a Best Actor award, Eddie Murphy, for the 9 different performances he gave in one movie, you know?
God, that's so interesting. Because they do say comedy is tougher than drama, but it doesn't get the respect. Yeah. Acting coaches will tell you.
They always say that, but then they never give it to a pure comedic performance. Like, you look at somebody like, look at Arthur and, you know, Dudley Moore and Arthur, which is a heartbreaking as well as hilarious performance. Yeah. And I don't even know if he was nominated. John Gielgud got nominated, right? Yeah. And he was doing kind of like the straight man, but the funny with all the great one-liners. And they also revere him. And he did so much with that character that made it so memorable that he won the Academy Award. But watch Dudley Moore in that movie. It's delightful and funny and heartbreaking and believable and hilarious and playing a drunk. And there's just great comic performances that don't get the respect or something that someone that we just think of as serious acting. And they say comedy, we all know comedy is, you know, dying is easy, comedy is hard, but they really go, no, not really.
Yeah, it's so wild. Did you know that like Eddie Murphy's acting inspiration is Peter Sellers, who nominated for an Oscar?
Sure.
He died and had to play something serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was blown away. I was listening to a podcast when the second Coming to America is coming out, and they brought that up, and I go, wait, what? And I was so impressed and also hit myself in the head. I'm like, of course that's like his hero.
Yeah.
If people don't know Peter Sellers, Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, he plays 3 characters completely different from each other. He's supposed to play a fourth. And that performance is so amazing.
Yes.
And could only be done by him.
Yes.
And there's great performances in that movie. George C. Scott's great. Sterling Hayden's great. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah.
But he did that shit his whole career. Yeah. Eddie, Coming to America, the barbershop, if they would have just casted random dudes to play that, it doesn't, the movie's not the same. Eddie could do that. But that's comedic chops. And that is like, that is kind of the diving in, give me the ball. It's just, all right, I walked in, I have to be funny now.
I mean, that's next level. It's next level stuff. Like when I talked about cartoons, if you watch the Shrek movies, you know, nobody could do what, you know, nobody's as funny. Nobody's that funny. Nobody. It's like next
he's
level.
Pound for pound.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's just like he's just on another dimension of comic skill sets. The gods just, you know, touched him, and he's just that good. And he works hard, obviously. I'm just saying, but that's just talent that's just off the charts. And few people like Rick have that magic, you know, that can do that. And to see that not get respected as much as some other performances that get, oh, that's a great performance. It's like not even close to what it took to do what Eddie did in that film.
It's crazy because they always have to say comedic in front of actor for certain ilk. That's how disrespected in a way we are. It's like Bill Murray's a great goddamn actor.
Yeah.
Who'll probably never get an Oscar.
Yeah.
And he got nominated. I'm sorry. I did not like Broken Flowers. And that's the one he gets nominated. And I think, and he was so disappointed when he didn't win because he's done so much great work as this comedic sniper in movies. And to get forgotten like that, they always throw that at people. It's like Lucille Ball is a great comedic actress. Yeah, because she was a great actress. Like she was terrific.
Yeah.
She could, the fact that she can make you laugh that consistently
is a
bonus, but she had depth. The part of her depth is what made you laugh.
Right. Yeah. Yeah,
it's so crazy.
That's just another pet peeve of how comedy is once again revered and disrespected at the same time.
We're here to tell you how the world is wrong. The world is wrong about
Mad Dog Time,
the paper boy.
Mordecai, after last season.
The World is Wrong is an extremely positive podcast where Andras Jones and Brian Connolly champion films The World is Wrong About. Available on Paperhouse Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
I can do that, and yet, and at the same time, you're an X-Man. It's like, hey, you're special, and that's so amazing. I've been told I'm pretty good, too. Fuck. All right.
Well, you know, it's funny. That's why I also have an issue with when they, I don't know why they keep doing it where they take actors and they make them play comedians. It drives me crazy because it's like when you see, I don't know, De Niro or somebody like that are really good actors, but stand-up comedy is such a freaky different animal, and not many people have the chops to play stand-up, pure stand-up, you know, and they always have the sometimes, and you know, the one of the few people who pulled it off was Hanks in Punchline. If you watch Punchline, he's really good in that. But most of the time, you see people trying hard. They're not aware that what they're doing. And De Niro was great in like King of Comedy, where he, you know, played a bad comic. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it was just hilarious. And but a lot of times, and I love De Niro. But a lot of times when they get an actor and they go, "You're going to play a stand-up comic." And you see them on stage doing that, it's like, that's something that really is a unique thing that you need to have in your body and do a lot, you know, before you can really embody that. And I'm not being like a snob. I'm literally saying, when I see somebody do it well, I'm like, oh, you're playing a comedian. Great. You know, and I've seen actors do it. But a lot of times I go, oh, you're not selling the joke. That's not how we know. Right.
But you can tell a difference. So like, I wonder if people can. Like, I wonder if people watch Funny People right now, if they could tell the difference between the main cast and the comics who were hitting the store and the improv every night.
Right.
Because, I mean, when you take that role, you end up getting spots. I think someone calls. They end up working out. Apparently, Aubrey Plaza in Funny People, who's not a comedian, got so good at it. Also was on a TV show, so she had the heat. They asked her to put in her avails at places.
Oh, that's funny.
That they're like, just keep sending in. It's like, no, we wrapped the film, and I have to move on to my day job, which is Parks and Rec and this other film. Right. Yeah, but, you know, we got a couple days open. You know, why don't you just put in the work?
There's cases of that. And I've just noticed that when I see it, somebody who hasn't done stand-up, And I'm always checking myself, going, is this just because you're a stand-up and you want to think it's special and nobody can do it but you? And I'm like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a certain. I love that seeing there's a commitment to stand-up that people who are trying to be funny or think they're supposed to be funny as a comedian don't necessarily bring, because comedians take comedy very seriously. You know, like we take it very seriously, whereas people who try to play a comedian think they're being funny, whereas comedians don't do that, right? That's what makes us good at it, is we take that shit as life and death, which is the kind of thing, because we've done it so much, so that's the difference between a guy playing a comic who's an actor who thinks he's supposed to be funny, and a comic who knows that it's not about being funny. It's about staying alive. Okay. Like as a comic, and the stakes are much higher in your psyche, and getting that in your body, you know, is very important. I have to go at 3, by the way.
We're going to wrap this up, my friend. And I thank you so much. This is great.
No, this is great. I didn't know who the hell knew we were going to go off on this particular tangent.
But that's the beauty of it. Like I said, we go with a fishbone now, and then I want it to be working comics discussing what's in our head about it and the passion. And that's what people want, and that's what I want to put out. And it's really the essence of this show. And so I'll give you this to close. And doing this for years, and you do protect our business. And I'm glad you just touched upon this. you love this business and protect us. Is there one thing you are seeing right now with like younger comics, greener comics coming in that you think needs to be eliminated or is problematic?
We could do a whole show on stuff like that. Not necessarily pet peeves, but the idea of one of my biggest things now is this idea of like, you can't talk up when people say you can't talk about anything. You can't talk about anything on stage. And I always am like, yeah, you can, but the difficulty level is higher in terms of what you're going to tackle, and the expectation level from crowds can be. I'm not defending woke culture. I am saying that because I feel a strong sense of reverence for this art form as an arena for experimentation and expansion of what's okay to talk about, very much so, especially when you're doing open mic nights or doing new material that you're trying out that hasn't been honed. And you should be able to touch on many things. But what I often hear people say, you can't joke about anything. And I always go, well, yeah, but if you're gonna take on abortion or you're gonna take on race or you're gonna take on, you know, sexual issues or gender issues or trans issues or something like that, then you better bring your A game. Okay, you know, because just saying some cheap hack thing, you know, when people go, oh, you can't say anything. Well, that joke sucked. You know, don't use that as an excuse.
No, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that you should be able to. I mean, yeah, you should be able to, but you should be funny because you're a comedian. So bring something unique and original to the table. And I mean, you'll have to talk to other comedians, have different opinions about this, obviously, and I respect that. But I also wonder, when I see people say you can't talk about anything, I always go, but can't you really, or is it that you have to really find a really unique angle on it if you're going to make a point? Well, I mean, I welcome your thoughts on this because I don't.
I think it's an absolutely valid point. I am at the same time sick of people being managed by people who don't do comedy as you shouldn't say this and that's offensive, even though I'm not that person. People are using it as a fucking scapegoat for lazy writing and lazy performing. Yeah. I can't say nothing anymore. You can if you're goddamn good and you can handle it.
Yeah.
And it's tough. And if you can't, if you're not that good, you shouldn't probably talk about AIDS, abortion, race, shit like politics, because that is a chemical that could explode if you don't handle it right. And it's high risk, high reward. It's cryptocurrency, buddy. Those are cryptocurrencies.
Absolutely. That's the deal. And it's like, if you're going to do you can't joke about this. You should never do a rape joke. It's like, well, if you can do a rape joke, let's hear it. What do you got? And it better be really, really good, because the expectation level of what's expected for a joke like that can't be cheap and it can't be easy. And it's like, so bring it, baby, bring it on, and that's what makes the magic happen, baby.
Right. Brian, thank you so much. Where can everyone find you? Get some plugs out, baby.
Brian, B. Scott McFadden on Instagram and Twitter and online, and be BrianScottMcFadden.com. And just find me on there, become a Twitter follower. I'm bad at the whole. I don't know how good you are at that stuff, but I'm just like the worst.
People think I'm good, and I don't. I sound like I'm good at selling, and I'm fucking fail all the time. But it's worth the try. Yeah. Go follow Brian. He's the best. Support me, the James Madden Instagram and the Twitters and the TikToks. Keep rating and subscribing and writing comments. We appreciate you. The support and the love is so great. Thank you all so much for that. Support Silk City Hot Sauce, our sponsor. Go there right now. Promo code commish. Get 15% off. Fill your goddamn shells full of hot sauce and get 15% off. It's a great way to do it. Mad love to Nick Angelo on production. JSS1 for artwork. Paperhouse Network. And come see me at New York Comedy Club Memorial Day weekend, where we're doing the check spot. They're filming me, audio, cameras. I am going on while the bills are being paid, doing a Q&A. When you buy a ticket, you better fucking have questions ready at the end of the show. So check that out. Mad love. We'll see y'all next week. Thank you, everybody.
Got it, brother.